continues its descent into self-parody, Europe also stands on the brink of change. The European Commission is preparing to appoint a new president via the Spitzenkandidat system, first used in the aftermath of the 2014 European Parliament elections.
We have to take the people along. People have fears, they have hopes, they have dreams, they have aspirations. And what Europe can provide is the answer.
Don't let your democratic mandate be ridiculed or diminished. Stand up for it. You are the representatives of more than 500 million people.
The process was not very transparent. I'm a very unique guy. I was the first and the last Spitzenkandidat.
Six formal candidates for EU's top job.
And does anyone know anything about them?
Do you know any of them?
No.
And do you know him?
No.
Any idea?
No, honestly not.
Have you ever seen her?
No.
What's really going on in the corridors of Brussels? That's the question we're asking on this episode of the Another Europe is Possible podcast with Luke Cooper from Anglia Ruskin University and Zoe Williams from The Guardian. This week, we're delighted to welcome back the award-winning journalist and virtuoso pun merchant Stephen Bush from The New Statesman to lead us along the jungle paths of Europe's sprawling technocracy. One of the first lobby reporters to predict Jeremy Corbyn's shock win in 2015, curiously, he remains one of the few voices on the left who still wants the Corbyn machine to keep its Brexit fudge. Suffice it to say, we're not great fans of this view, but to hear him out on that, you'll have to sign up as an Another Europe member to gain access to this week's extra time. To join the campaign, go to anothereurope.org/join. Hope you enjoy it.
So, Stephen, welcome to the show. Before we get down to the details, can you start by giving our listeners a rough guide to the Spitzenkandidat system, please?
So the theory of the system is that essentially during the European Parliament elections, although nominally the parties compete in their own countries, all of the parties are part of European-wide groupings. The Labour Party is part of the Party of European Socialists. That kind of does what it says on the tin. The Conservatives, until relatively recently, used to be part of the European People's Party, which is the kind of main centre-right Christian Democratic party. Then, because David Cameron didn't want it to be away from, you know, scary words like federalism, he formed a kind of party for like right-wing parties and were slightly too weird to be in the EPP, but not full-on fash enough to be in one of the kind of really weird and deeply unpleasant groups. And they all nominate a Spitzenkandidat before the elections as their president-designate, as the person who will hold the top job if they win the European elections. And that's essentially the theory of the Spitzenkandidat system, is in that way we all pick who leads rather than it being the mechanics of some leaders and horse trading behind closed doors.
So it all sounds wonderful. But what happened this time?
So Emmanuel Macron does not like the Spitzenkandidat system. I essentially think because his conception of pro-Europeanism is one where strong national leaders and a strong France can project itself by making deals, breaking things, doing grand bargains. And there are many reasons why the Spitzenkandidat system does not lend itself to that, not least that his party, En Marche, is not part of one of the big European groupings. They're part of the third biggest European grouping, Renew Europe, which is nominally an alliance of liberals, although that runs from your kind of fairly classic centrist liberal party like the Liberal Democrats, social liberal parties like D66, and then parties which are actually just traditional parties of the right, but are, for historical reasons, in the liberal grouping. So partly because they're slightly more incoherent internally, they are always less able to effectively lobby for themselves. I mean, they've now renamed themselves Renew Europe because that was a condition for Macron of being in it, because the word liberal has essentially in France the same connotations as the word neoliberal. You might say, looking at many of the political choices he's made, quite why he doesn't want to be attached to the idea of extreme economic liberalism, but it's much more, it's a phrase people had about Sarkozy's attempted reform. So he felt that it was more loaded, which is why it's now called Renew Europe, but he doesn't like the system. He wanted to disrupt it, and he particularly did not like Manfred Weber, who was the centre-right's candidate, and as the centre-right had won these elections, albeit narrowly, he was the person he wanted wanted to frustrate.
So, hang on a sec. Did the Party of European Socialists stand a good chance then? Are they the joint second party with the EPP?
Yes, so they came second. So the Macron championed as his kind of alternative to Weber because he had finished second. He had been a Spitzen candidate. The Party of European Socialists did want him to be their candidate. And also, one of the really interesting things about the system this time is, although I'm not going to pretend that I think the whole of Europe went wild for this system, one of the interesting and I think heartening things is clearly it was a factor in the European elections in the Netherlands, where Timmermans, who is Dutch, is popular. The idea of him leading Europe did cause them to get their best result in an election in the Netherlands for 7 years. And here in the Labour Party, where it was obviously a more difficult election cycle for the British Labour Party than the Dutch one, they nonetheless, MPs, MEP candidates and activists all did use on the doorstep this line when asked about, you know, why shouldn't I vote for a sort of more pure Remain party? Look, there is this European-wide agenda. There's this guy called Timmermans. There's the ability to change the EU. And I don't think that's that particularly helped them retain votes, but I do think it is positive for all pro-Europeans that in two countries, at least, it featured somewhere in the conversations that parties were having.
Labour activists made this point. Labour MEPs made this point. I don't think the Labour leader made this point.
That's what really angered me, was that when the PES manifesto came out, it was this radical, huge vision. I'll just say for the listeners what it was. It was kind of Green New Deal, new social contract, wage floors, everything you could want from a kind of renewed Europe and a socially democratic to transnational corporation. But Jeremy Corbyn kind of nodded it through when the PES was signing it off. And then he didn't refer to it in the EU elections at all. As the Socialist Commission for Europe, we posited it to one page. All the MEPs signed up to it. We sent it to Corbyn's office and said, can we use this as a document? Not only did they not reply, we finally got a reply 7 weeks after the EU elections, which said, thank you for your comments. Obviously, being Labour, we agree with your vision, but we also respect the referendum result. It was like literally, fuck you. I mean, it was unbelievable. So I'm glad they got 14%. Okay, that's the end of my rant.
The official Zoe line. So to go back to your point about Macron, I think this is a really interesting case around France's vision, because on some ways Macron has done more than anyone else, writing to all European citizens, say we need a new reform vision for Europe. It was in The Guardian, it was in all of these different titles across Europe. You know, this big forward vision, very progressive. On the other hand, I do feel that he quite likes the horse trading power element of it. And there's a certain irony in his attacks on Orban and the V4 countries that are obviously horrible far-right governments. But in a sense, they do share a similar conception of European integration, which is yes to integration, yes to as much integration as possible when it's in our national interests. And until you get over that issue, Europe's going to have a problem.
So we should scroll back to what actually happened, because Timmermans did not get elected. Is that correct?
Yeah, we should. So I also had the misfortune and embarrassment in during this 3-day European Council of tweeting very enthusiastically on Monday morning when diplomats from the European Council were briefing journalists saying, hey, well, it's going to go to Timmermans. It's definitely going to go to Timmermans. Now there's just horse trading over the other positions, which is European Central Bank, etc. And I was like, socialists, take back the Commission presidency, high five emoji and everything. And obviously, 2 days later, Lexiteers on Twitter had found this tweet and went, oh, this tweet aged well, didn't it? As the centre-right keep hold of the European Commission. So they have their new candidate, which is a obscure minister from the German government. It was the Minister of Defence, Ursula von der Leyen, who is going to be the new Commission president. And I don't think we know very much about her, do we? I think she's from the more social justice left of the CDU.
Yeah, so she's someone who was talked up for, it feels like, most of the last 5 years, the kind of question of when is Angela Merkel going to step down, who's going to be her replacement. And she's one of the people who kind of was briefly talked up as someone. She's, you know, on the centre of politics, on the left of the CDU. Now, the slightly odd thing is from the outside you might go, but hasn't the Grand Coalition worked out brilliantly for the CDU? They've essentially crushed the life out of every party who's had the misfortune to go into coalition with them and stolen a lot of their authenticity from them by being quite comfortable with borrowing social democratic-ish positions. But quite a large chunk of the CDU wants to have a kind of clearer, more explicitly right-wing political position, although it is not clear what any of those people believe their path to a majority for that is. But van der Leyen is one of the people who had been seen as someone who would be a continuity Merkel candidate. Because her tenure as defence minister has not been seen as particularly successful, she's had a series of difficult gaffes, partly because of a long-term underinvestment in German defence. So her star waned. So she's sort of like, you know, a kind of rising star which didn't ever quite make it. It is, I think, a bit of a coup for Merkel to, A, have managed to maintain having a German in the commission, and also to have got essentially a lifeboat for a political ally who I think is not going to survive in the post-Merkel era for a variety of reasons.
And this raises a challenge or issue now for socialists inside the European Parliament. So in the Byzantine structures of the European Union, we have the European Council that has made its choice. Now, it's kind of the European Council's decision, but then the European Parliament has to vote in favour of this choice, and that will happen in, well, depending on when we broadcast this, actually, but it's going to happen in 10 days from now. So the European Parliament is going to vote on it. And so socialists can kind of vote for this candidate in relatively good conscience. And I don't know if they will. I mean, they're really annoyed that Timmermans didn't get it. However, it's not Manfred Weber. So Manfred Weber was the Spitzen candidate for the CDU and its allies, the European People's Party, in the European Parliament, and is generally seen to be much more on the right wing from actually the Christian Social Union, which is the Bavarian party, much more conservative, very anti-immigration, and has played a very dangerous game with the rise of Orbán in Hungary by saying to the Western European audience, hey, I don't like him, this is bad. To the East European audience, don't worry, we've got your back, we'll look after you.
I don't understand how Timmermans didn't get it.
So essentially, he didn't get it for two reasons. Firstly, because, and actually this is part of the interesting sort of paradox of Macron's approach to European power politics, even though he had a very successful set of negotiations, if you went, what did he want at the start of this process? He didn't want Weber, and he's not that keen on the Spitzen candidate, and he wanted a top job for someone in his parliamentary group, and they had not had a commission job for some time. And nominally, he achieved all of that. Well done him. But the reason why he didn't get his first choice is, A, because the manner that he went about it annoyed some people, and there was an element of, well, if he's happy with Timmermans as his first choice, then it cannot be Timmermans. And also because Timmermans has been incredibly robust and very strong on the erosion of democratic norms in parts of Eastern Europe, and indeed in Italy, Orbán and others did not want him to be the candidate, which is ultimately why he came to grief. Of course, you can force things through on the position of veto, which is what happened with David Cameron and Jean-Claude Juncker. I think the reason why that did not happen this time is Cameron did not have an alternate candidate. He just sat there going, not Juncker, not Juncker, not Juncker. Because there was an alternate candidate sort of floating around loose in van der Leyen, it meant that they kind of were able to revert back to that sort of old shape.
One of the things that I don't really understand is that it's a qualified majority vote on the council, right? Mm-hmm. But they insisted on going for consensus. Now, the European Commission have this amazing app that if you're a bit of a geek like me, you can use to on your phone to work out the qualified majority vote, which is 16 countries and 65% of European populations. So you need an app to work it out. It's mm-hmm. not something you can do with a bit of paper. And, you know, if you add the V4 countries and if you add Italy together, they still didn't have a blocking power within the council.
Okay.
But the council decided to go for consensus that led to this peculiar thing that you get to the end of the whole situation and Merkel abstains while everyone else votes in favour. And the reason Merkel abstained is because her coalition partners in Germany, the Social Democrats, mm-hmm. didn't like the outcome.
They didn't like van der Leyen.
Yeah, they wanted Timmermans.
They wanted Timmermans. I had two follow-up questions. One of them was, what kind of numbers, what kind of proportions are we talking? If EPP is the biggest and PES is the second biggest, the Renew Europe
are the
the third.
Yeah.
And then the hard right is split, presumably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Between Orban's lot and the even worse lot.
No, so Orban is in the centre-right European People's Party, even though he's a far-right
leader. Oh, really? I didn't know that. Why haven't they kicked him out?
Well, he's currently suspended from membership, but he's likely to be readmitted.
I see.
It's politics as well, because they would lose. It's the third biggest group in the European People's Party.
What, the Hungarians?
Yeah, the Fidesz, because they get 50% of the vote in Hungary. They're massive.
So that's really interesting. That makes more sense of going for consensus, right? Because if you're
the parliament is paralysed. It's in a sense. I mean, if social democrats don't vote for this in the parliament, it's very unlikely for it to go through, because the far right will vote against it. Mm. The liberals will vote in favour. The greens will vote against it, and the European People's Party will vote in favour. But they won't. It's hard for the EPP to get a majority for this without the socialists supporting them.
And the socialists are now supporting this candidate?
Well, it's very controversial inside the Party of European Socialists, but I get the feeling from talking to people that they will support it. So, you know, they've got the High Representative, which is like the EU foreign policy person. They'll get Timmermans as vice president.
Right.
So there's a bit of horse trading there, so I'd imagine they will end up voting for it. But from what I understand, the Labour faction of the Party of European Socialists won't vote in favour of it, so there'll be divisions all over the place.
And is there no whipping, presumably? They vote how they want, even when they're within a group.
So there are essentially two tiers of whips. There's an all-party group whip, where they all sit in caucus together, and then there are whips within the pan-European party for the ones that are elected. Because essentially, there is an open question about whether or not are you better off as a European socialist vetoing this and hoping that you can get something better through more horse trading? Or do you go, we've actually done quite well across a variety of junior posts. When you add the fact that the Liberals have someone for the first time, it means this commission is slightly more left-wing. I mean, it's still not left-wing, but it's a leftward move from what it was last time. Is it more useful to try and build a constructive centre-left green majority for next time than not rock the boat this time? It's really difficult to know. But for various individual parties, actually, their interests are a lot more open and shut. For the German Social Democrats, they don't like that the Spitzenkandidat system has been abandoned, and they don't like that they feel it kind of happened without their consent by their coalition partners, which obviously is always the problem of any coalition. Then you split the ministers up, and then people can, in their own departmental briefs, go, surprise, you know, we've done X. So they will come down in different places. So it's not certain that van der Leyen will make it.
Yeah, and I was reading about the Social Democrat, Josep Borrell, who's going to be the High Representative. And it's a peculiar choice because he's from Catalonia, from Spain, but a socialist. He's very strongly against Catalonian independence, so like everyone is in Spain, basically. But that leads into these foreign policy positions that are a bit peculiar. So he's against recognising Kosovo, for example, which is quite normal in the liberal West for amongst European countries. Like, you'd probably recognise Kosovo independence. He's very anti-Russia, but he's seen as a bit close to Iran. And he's famous for making undiplomatic statements. So the previous High Commissioner, Federica Mogherini, also Social Democrat, has gravitas, a real diplomat. So it's a peculiar choice. So I think it would be interesting to see where that ends up. Do we want to say anything more about the particular positions, or should we go on to ask about whether there's been more attention on this in Britain this time and what it means for Brexit?
I think we should talk about what it means for Brexit, and we should also talk about what the Brexit Party and their behaviour mean for British politics.
All right, yeah, that's a good set of questions. So there has been more attention on it, but is it just a slow news week?
It has been a very slow news week. But this row did dominate the British press last time because of Cameron's doomed attempt to block Claude Juncker, where he never grasped, and you cannot say, I don't want this, if you do not have a list of alternatives. But I think actually the one positive outcome of Brexit, like I said, there are two positive outcomes of Brexit. Outcome one is that it has lost the Conservatives their majority and paralysed the Conservative government. And the other positive outcome is that people in this country are more engaged in Europe as an idea. Unfortunately, not everyone in the United Kingdom is engaged in the European, but it has ironically made us more European and has made British pro-Europeans more organised and better connected with one another, right? I think that is partly why people are more excited by it and are more engaged in it than they have been in the past.
And does it make any effect on Brexit? I mean, I suppose one of the things is that the old commission is still in place in this transitional phase until November anyway, mm-hmm. and Brexit Day is 31st of October. Is it going to affect things, these choices?
So I think it matters a bit to Brexit. Whoever is in the Commission right there, their preference will continue to be to avoid catastrophic no deal where possible, and ideally to try and keep the United Kingdom within the project. However, I wasn't expecting them to wake up this morning, go on this podcast and say something positive about, you know, Donald Tusk, a man on the Polish centre-right. But Tusk is someone who absolutely understands that the European Union is a peace project, who sees it as integral to the arrival of democracy and liberty, and does see the pro-European, you know, movements we have here as something he has a commonality with from his political origins as someone fighting Soviet tyranny. And that meant that he was always going to be someone who was more likely to make sympathetic noises about the UK, about us staying in. And when you have people making noises off from other member states saying, these guys have clogged up our structures for 3 years, they've never been good Europeans, couldn't we just gently ease them out? It does, I think, slightly change the centre of gravity in those debates away from someone who will do that. It also is significant, whether it's a second referendum, an election with revoke on the ballot, or whether it's rejoining, right? It does slightly change the type of EU that we would either be seeking to rejoin or remain in it, partly because it moves it slightly to the left of where it was. So that's a positive, I think, in terms of how you'd construct the argument for staying in or going back in. But I also think it is a negative both for the EU as a whole and indeed for the UK. This is a commission essentially that will be run by the centre of Europe, with very little representation for Central and Eastern Europeans, and also actually very little representation for the Dutch. And the Irish are essentially our big allies in terms of what we've tried to do as a European level for a long time. So it does, I think, make it slightly harder for pro-Europeans, a less sympathetic UK president in terms of what we're trying to do, and in many ways, perhaps an EU that will change in ways that British people might not like.
Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to think what the best way to play that would be as a kind of from a revoke stance or a rejoin stance, because it would seem that the obvious thing to say is, you know, there are kind of socialists within the commission prominently, but it feels like that's sort of a bit of a fig leaf for what is essentially a status quo candidate. Is that right?
So I suppose there were different positions. I mean, Tusk's position was as the chair of the European Council, which is the body that's just nominated the president. And so his job is to defend the interests of the nation states. He's been replaced by Charles Michel, the Belgian prime minister, from the liberal centre, as Stephen was saying. And he's more inclined to Macron's hard line on any concessions. But I think a lot of it is quite machismo, really.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes down to it, I don't believe Macron or Michel will say no to an extension request. And, you know, we have this weird psychodrama of Tory leadership contest going on at the moment. Essentially, I don't think that there would be a big difference between what Hunt does and what Johnson does. I think the big difference between them is that Johnson has much more influence amongst leavers, so he can lead the retreat much more easily, right? Yeah. And, you know, this is why George Osborne at the Evening Standard came out very strongly, backed
I've got intel on that, actually. Do you want me to say it? That has come directly from Lebedev, and George Osborne did not want to back Boris Johnson.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah, and the comment editor nearly walked out over it.
How interesting.
I know.
Well, either way, whether it's Osborne or Lebedev, the logic of what the editorial said is that ask yourself, is this the best person to lead the retreat? I think that's quite telling. He might well lead the retreat because you're going to get towards exit day. And I'd imagine whether it's Boris Johnson or Jeremy Hunt, they're going to ask for an extension again.
Is this a good time to just plot whichever scenario we think we're going in with Brexit quickly?
Yeah. See what Stevens thinks.
My one source of comfort about the fact that Boris Johnson looks like he's going to become Prime Minister is this is a man whose overarching political project is A, to be Prime Minister, and B, is this desperate desire to be liked. And he's going to find that those two dreams cannot be reconciled with one another. Mm. Particularly, you cannot do a no deal if your big priority is for everyone to love you. Equally, you can't extend if your dream is to be a Conservative Prime Minister who everyone likes. I do think Parliament will find some way of forcing the executive to seek an extension. And then I think we end up in an election. I think it kind of makes sense from a Conservative perspective. Their best chance of getting out of that, of the mess they're in, is an election where they can go, Parliament's blocking us, give us a majority to go ahead and do it. It will, of course, be kept carefully under wraps. I then can't work out, until Brexit is resolved, how anyone can win a parliamentary majority. So I think you then end up with a parliament that is probably even more deadlocked than this one, and perhaps extended extension. Or maybe Boris Johnson does have the credibility to say, Parliament's blocking me, the only way we can get Brexit is to put my deal, which will essentially be May's deal with a coat of Latin, to the people, and he will hope that that gets him out of his hole.
Yep, absolutely. So it's Boris Johnson, either Parliament blocks or he gets cosmetic changes to the deal, and there's a good chance that he gets it through Parliament. I think he needs 42 switches in the vote. Not impossible that you could get that under all of the pressure of building up to exit day.
Well, that's it for those of you who are listening on the regular podcast platforms. But if you're feeling flush, we now have extra time available for paid-up members of Another Europe Is Possible. To join the campaign, go to anotheureup.org/join. In this week's extra time, we ask Stephen how he'd reform the Spitzenkandidat process, and we give him a hard time for suggesting that Labour should hedge its bets before embracing a Remain and Reform position. Hope to see you there.
So, Stephen, into extra time. In an ideal world, how would you elect the Commission President?
I mean, in an ideal world, I actually think that the Spitz and candidate system works pretty well. Okay, it's only at the beginning of its life, but I think, yeah, having a situation where the parties agree before that they are going to elect a particular person if they win the European elections, and they're going to be elections all over the bloc, and they will try to be about European-wide things, is the only sort of stable and sustainable way to a genuine European demos. There are many things I find incoherent and silly about Lexit as an argument, but there is a caucus of people in this country who think it is more plausible that Bernie Sanders will get 51 Democrats elected to the Senate who are pro some kind of redistribution, with the huge influence of money, America's incredibly anti-socialist culture. They think that is more likely than the idea that a group of countries, all of which have elected social democrats and further left parties than that in their own relatively recent history, might be able to construct some kind of progressive majority at a European level. And yet it's somehow the European one that is implausible. I kind of think that until the advantage of having that system for the European Parliament is, one, it does give people a focus to talk about generally European issues. Unfortunately, the nature of human affairs is what essentially happens at the moment is the party which is doing worse domestically pivots to talking about European issues. The good thing about democracy, though, is eventually everyone is the party doing worse domestically, and it does, I think, the Spitz and Candidat gradually moves the axis of European elections away from, is this an opportunity to kick whoever the Prime Minister is, and towards, what type of Europe do we want? And the second you have that conversation, one, I genuinely believe that the politics of consensus building inclines people towards left-wing outcomes eventually. I also believe that it's only if you have that European-wide conversation, and this is why I think Macron's approach to European reform is utterly a hold below the waterline. Unless you have a European sense of identity, you are never going to get political support for risk-sharing and social transfers within the Eurozone and the wider European Union.
I agree with lots of that. I mean, I agree with all of that. But I, generally speaking, my politics isn't to favour kind of presidential systems. However, I think when it comes to Europe, it would be quite powerful if there was a direct election for the Commission President, because you cut out the horse trading, and this seems like a flight of fancy, but I mean, it has been put forward by that well-known radical Jean-Claude Juncker just a year ago. You know, he said, well, my dream is a directly elected European President.
And directly elected by the citizens, people of Europe.
Yeah, yeah. By citizens, just have a big presidential election. It'd inspire a lot of enthusiasm. It would cynic. You're meant to be a member of a pro-European radical reform campaign.
I really am. That really is what I am. I mean, I guess I'm just thinking that, you know, to directly elect the president requires a very high level of expertise in the difference between one candidate and another.
Well, I say that one of the difficulties of the Spitzenkandidat system, although Stephen was making really good points about consensus systems and moving to the left that are very interesting and I haven't thought about. But look, the problem with it is that Europe at the moment is too polarised and too paralysed. So there's kind of two Spitzenkandidats that have a chance, the Socialists and the Christian Democrats. But even then, their combined weight in the European Parliament is less than 50%. So maybe there's just an optimistic conclusion from that is the Socialists have to do a lot better and less people have to vote for the far right, and maybe they will, and all of that stuff.
Yeah. Okay, so are we going to attack Stephen at the very end?
In case
we upset him and he walks out.
I see your strategy. It's the best time to attack
him.
Okay,
so why have you been arguing against Labour taking a Remain and Reform position? For the love of God, why?
I'm going to switch between my two different hats, right? If the question is, what do I think Labour's best electoral strategy on the whatever of July it is, where I think it has to be to wait and see where the lie of the land is politically when Boris Johnson has become Prime Minister. One, because it might mean that from their perspective, they don't need to move towards people like me on a European issue because they'll be able to use the big terrifying spectre of Boris Johnson to corral enough of us back. Also, right, they're not going to be believed if they turn around and go, we've been hit so hard by the Liberals and Greens and that somehow knocked us into thinking this is a good idea. If they move now, they move from such a position of weakness, and I just don't think anyone believes it. I think Boris Johnson becoming leader, A, gives them an opportunity to see if they still need to, but allows them to finesse that move in a way which might actually be believed by some people and also might carry the whole of their party with them, which is to go, look, we have had a sharpening of the contrasts here. This is the candidate of no deal. The only way to stop this is X. And I still think from their interest perspective, that is true. From what I would like perspective, I would like them to have been in a pro-Remain position for a lot longer. However, they aren't. They haven't been. And so the question then becomes, well, what do I think they ought to do in terms of the interest of what they want to do, which is win an election? I do think one of the major, major problems, and basically almost everyone in the Labour Party has had, is they have seen their Brexit position as this kind of like, how are we going to win small towns, or how are we going to withhold Remainers? I keep reading sort of very detailed plans by people who are pro-Lexit going, oh, and then we'd reform the state. And it's just like, do you understand that the process of Brexit in of itself is a massive reform of the state? Then you have to reform a bunch of things to stay still. This idea that you at the same time are going to have a kind of profound politics of combating climate change while also removing yourself from the EU is just obviously nonsense, right? It is a lot more complicated than walking and chewing gum at the same time. It'd be basically saying, oh, I know, we'll have one big governing project in order to appease some voters in small towns, but we'll also have time to do our other big governing project, which is crazy. And that is where they ought to have started from, is a position of Brexit will never, ever be worth it from a left-wing perspective, as well as being a regressive step. Actually, even if this Lexit idea was achievable, it literally is saying what we'll do is we'll spend 20 years leaving the EU in order to hopefully do some left-wing things outside of the EU's rulemaking structures in 2 decades' time, right? That is a mad politics. And they ought to have started from that position. They haven't, which means what you're left with is what do I think they ought to do in order to maximise their way out of that, I would say, strategic mistake. And I think they are much better off waiting until the Conservatives have made their change, because that's the only way then they're going to be able to finesse a change of position and doesn't look like they've been bullied into it.
Well, that's annoying. We can't have a go at him now.
Well, no, I mean, I'm just thinking, because our line has always been, well, has recently been, if you look at where Labour are polling, not if they're on 18%, then they really are screwed, but if they're on 24% and the Tories are on 22% and the combined Remain forces are on 21%, there is a chance in that landscape they could clean up, albeit in coalition with the SNP and so on. But there's a huge amount of jeopardy in that position, because if it just has to break 1 or 2% in the other direction, and then they're completely obliterated, they're down to 130 seats. So they need to go into an election polling 30, 35%. And it seems to me impossible to do that without being the party of Remain.
The thing is, though, is do they have to be a party of Remain to be the party of Remain voters? I don't know. I just feel that if I were in their shoes, seeing as the Conservative Party is about to hang a big "we're closed" sign, and, you know, Remainers, we don't want your vote, over themselves, if I were them, I would think maybe they can.
But I think the credibility, how to make the retreat, is a very strong argument. I mean, we've been arguing that one big speech where Corbyn's just got to admit that he got it wrong a bit or misjudge public sentiment, but did it for the right reasons. So it's sincere, it's honest, and says, these are all the things that I believe in. This is my radical program, and this is how it connects to staying in Europe. I'm sure one big speech could still shift.
My really strong feeling is that there is no such thing as a Remainer who really cares about Labour and is prepared to put their Remain sentiments to one side in order to vote Labour. The reason being that they haven't been transmitting, oh, this is really difficult for us, bear with us while we make this difficult choice and balance between all of you. They've been incredibly arrogant, and they've lost a number of the kind of reputational things like authenticity, honesty, porousness, pluralism, democracy, all of that stuff. They've really squandered it. And I don't think there is this kind of that group of people who would prefer to remain, but prefer above all to stay Labour.
As a former Labour advisor said to me recently, we were much better at doing politics when we were stupid. So the argument was that the 2017 election, we were the stupid people doing politics. Hey, here's our programme. We go out and make the argument for our programme. We don't know anything about professional politics or triangulation or anything like that. We just go out and do it, and people liked it, and we did well, and we surprised ourselves. Then 2017 happened, paralysis ensues, and this idea that we just need one further step to power creates this small C conservatism where they don't want to say anything. You know, so they just avoid making positions or making arguments on any question.
Yeah, I think that is exactly the problem, right? That I actually think their Brexit position is much more damaging, not because it is a pro-Brexit position, but because it is a Labour Party management position, right? It is identical to the position that Yvette Cooper would have had or Andy Burnham would have had. And actually, I think, as Liz Kendall would have had, I think any of those people faced with the various actors and factions within the Labour Party would have ended up with this, like, fudging and mudging, don't rule anything out, don't rule anything in position. But the promise and the success of Corbynism in 2017 was it was not fudging and mudging, don't rule anything out, don't rule anything in politics. And yeah, and I think that is much more toxic, partly because the one advantage of Boris Johnson from a maximising the Conservatives' electoral chances perspective is he is able to say, I'm not like other politicians. Of course, the problems are the ways he's not like other politicians, he's incompetent, venal, etc., etc. But I do think that is much more risky. And I think the nightmare for Labour is I think they end up changing either in a kind of, OK, we'd like you to stop hitting us, or after being dragged into it by conference or their Clause 5 meeting, which is exactly the kind of closed politics of we've heard the activists, but we prefer not to talk to them. I haven't closed my mind to the argument that the political disruption of Brexit not happening, I do think it will be a significant event in the life of the country if it does happen. I just don't think that it will be as significant as the consequences of it and the democratic harm of it happening would be. But because they've never gone, look, our position is actually it's here and we're not going to move, and this is why we're not going to move. One of the pro-Brexit rebels said to me, and this is someone who's not really a fan of Tony Blair either, they said the thing that Tony Blair would have done is he would have made everyone go out and sell the policy that they'd decided, whether it was popular or unpopular. He said, and probably would be in a better position if that's what Jeremy had done and just said, I don't care, we're just going to do this. But, you know, they are where they are. And I think they'll probably do need to work out a way that they can retreat without looking like they're just retreating for the political advantage.
Thanks to Stephen, and thanks to you for listening. If you've enjoyed today's show, please leave us a rating or review on your podcast platform. It makes a huge difference to our ability to reach new listeners. You can also contact us at podcast@anotheurope.org with feedback and suggestions for new content. We'll be back very soon. See you then.